Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tom, beer or coffee?
Gonna go with beer here because I can have a coffee porter or a coffee stout. Can't do it the other way around.
Yeah, I gave up beer. It's a carb issue. I'm a gay man in Los Angeles. We don't do it. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, down to 14, week two, kind of getting a feel for the field. We now have teams, respectively. You have seven contestants. I have seven contestants. So now the games begin. And it is a cast of thousands at the judges' tables.
Yeah, this is Fox pregame for Sunday afternoon football games. And there's 15... I don't know. Would you say that the CNN or the political shows are outdoing the NFL shows now with how many people they have at a table?
Right, because actually, like, I think with one of those networks, like CNN, they do like the satellite commentators table. Like, there's not even a – it's like Seder in my family back in the day. Like, you got to open up the other room for the other table.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of contestants here, and it's – Top Chef alums who are at the table, and it's great to see Carrie back. She's just a beacon of smiles. I feel like she's great, and it's good to see Mrs. Fancy Toast back on the podium. This was a really good episode, and a lot of dynamics here at play, you know, team dynamics here at play that I'd love to workshop with you here. Always one of my favorites is just strategy. A lot of strategy going on.
I have
on
this note, Tom, that how much you like watching when the scenario is pick your partner. This is the Tom Haberstroh special, because yeah. I know you like to see sort of how, because it's like one of the few completely like non-deterministic moments in the show. It's like, let the contestants decide sort of the strength of their team. And it does reveal so many. Not only does it reveal the way the contestants perceive each other as in terms of strength and weakness, sort of personal affinity, likability, compatibility. I know you love that.
Oh, it's a truth serum. I mean, those games at the backyard or the basketball court blacktop is, you know, select your team. It is a truth serum. You got to put your friendships aside and you just got to go, who the fuck am I going to choose to win this damn challenge? Or in this case, who am I going to win to survive?
Right.
So I love this.
Yeah.
But let's go from the top. So we had the Top Chef Diner, Kevin.
Right. This is the challenge is a breakfast short order. I thought a couple things were interesting because I thought there was a lot of redundancy in the ordering. Why is there nothing sweet? Nobody asked for French toast or crepes. Pancakes of some kind. So I was really surprised that you had like a lot of hash, a lot of fried eggs. There was no breakfast burrito. I was shocked. We're highlighting a lot of Latin American chefs. And I just thought that, you know, given the emphasis on Mexican food, there were breakfast burritos are like the greatest. I mean, one of the great culinary trends of the last 20 years in this country is the breakfast burrito. It is a dish so suited to breakfast. And so I thought that was surprising. So I liked the challenge itself and what it demanded of the contestants. Just thought it was like a lot of missed opportunities there.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way where there's a lot of eggs going on, but yeah, no waffles, you know, chicken and waffles or anything like that, and fried chicken and waffles. I think one of the best parts about this was that Richard Blaze was set up as the last one to drop the bomb, right? And I really liked that. It kind of was a little unfair when he dropped the bomb on Nelson and Chris about the corned beef hash, eggs over medium with the hash browns and the hollandaise. Like that is like that continental USA breakfast you see at every hotel restaurant, right? And he drops that at the end. And so I like the strategy here, Kevin, of like the little play of like you're in a fantasy football draft or an auction style draft and you got to nominate players. Do you want to spend all your money in the beginning or do you want to kind of lay in the weeds a little bit at the end? And obviously Chris and Nelson waited until the very end. But what about you, Kevin? If you were one of the chef testants here, would you have kind of bird in the hand, try to jump out early and try to get a dish ahead of time, or would you try to just wait this out and see if like a magical dish happens that you know you can do and you wait to spend your money?
No. I think the two guys who rung in for steak and eggs, because those are declared components. You know exactly what you can do, right? Shrimp and grits was another one where, hey, you got a protein, you got a starch, and you can doll it up. You can have some fun. There's a lot of versatility. It's an easier canvas, whereas like you wait around and here you get the kitchen sink. And I'll tell you another thing about that kitchen sink. As if there weren't 30,000 components, hollandaise is not something you can just start and leave. You've got to emulsify the butter. You have to stand there, dribble it out a little bit at a time. It is one of the more difficult technical task because you just can't, it's not like, I get it on the stove and then I'm going to go run to the pantry. You have to be present. You have to stand there. So it was a completely unreasonable ask. And to the judge's credit and Richard's credit, like they didn't really get dinged. I mean, no. The nice thing about the, like you couldn't finish on the bottom. I mean, it was a one-on-one. So the level of difficulty is the same for both challengers. They're not going up against the other chefs, except for the one. But yeah, I think the key here is you want to ring in when you got with shrimp and grits, steak and eggs, maybe a fried egg and a veggie hash. But dim sum was the most, I am shocked that Abhishek rung in. And by the way, so impressed that Shota doesn't care. Like, yeah, I'll do it. Shota is to me revealing himself, Tom, as the most gutsy advanced chef in this competition.
Oh, here we go.
Even better about my
Shota love fest. Here we go. Here we go, Kevin. Of course, you trade up for him, and now you're just showering him with praise and love.
I think this could be one of the most exceptional individual season performances we have seen on this show in 2 decades. I'm sold. Love what he's doing.
Why do you think no one buzzed in for dim sum? Do you think it's just, I don't know. Was it Melissa? Like, is part of it just a little bit of fear of giving the plates to Melissa?
I think it's twofold. One is what we'll call the don't cook Indian for Padme syndrome, right? Like you don't want to have to live up to the home standard of the judge. Number two, dim sum's hard. Generally, you know, you could do spare ribs, you know, you come around and there's like those overly braised spare ribs on the cart, but generally speaking, it's noodles and dumpling. And so you have this, I mean, just think about how much harder noodles and dumplings are to do in 30 minutes than steak and eggs, right? So I just think in terms of level of difficulty, there aren't components that are defined. And so I think it is the don't cook Indian for Padma syndrome and the noodle dumpling difficulty.
Yeah. Shout out to Shota for that one. That looked like something he had done a billion times, and it was perfectly plated. I mean, it just looked like a perfect plate of food there. To do in a quick fire is super impressive. You know, the steak and eggs, they both looked great. Gabe comes out on top in that one, and then Shota comes out on the dim sum. And then Kwame drops out the shrimp and grits. And I'm just excited. Like whenever, like you said, whenever you can have a, you know, the two elements very easily defined in that, I'm jumping all over. So Jamie and Sarah get on that one. And my girl Jamie comes out with the creamy polenta with the gochujang shrimp. I mean, both of those dishes looked really good, but big upset here, Jamie taking over Sarah.
Look, I mean, her spot in Vegas is really well regarded. It's got a expansive menu. She has the profile of someone who should be, you know, good at Top Chef, creative but practical, right? And I think, you know, has an identity as a chef. And I think, yeah, it's like I already had seller's remorse. Like I already am sort of like, yeah, that's probably who I should have taken at 11 instead of Sasha, who we'll talk about later. One of the things I also found revealing about this quick fire is let's take the steak and eggs and dim sum real quickly. Steak and eggs demonstrated a creativity gap between the two chefs. You're starting to see, you know, Gabe does this, you know, chipotle adobo with a black garlic molasses steak.
Come on.
You know, and by the way, no disrespect to Byron, but, you know, T-bone chimichurri. Okay. It is a creativity gap in terms of the technical gap on the dim sum, right? As Avishar himself said, Shota, this guy is making mochi in 30 minutes. You know, a fritter, frankly, is a little bit of a crutch in this. And, you know, there's a reason you didn't see the fritters win. You saw the fritter lose in dim sum. You know, a very advanced chef like Sasha loses the fritter in the shrimp and grits. Fritters kind of, it's a little bit of a cop-out, to be perfectly honest. And so you're already seeing the technical gap. So one of the things I like about these one-on-ones is it does start to reveal, you know. I have a question for you, Tom, regarding one of your top picks. I think Dawn is as good as any chef in this competition in terms of technicality, in terms of just the ability to conceive ideas. Are you getting concerned about this time management issue?
Oh, yeah. Big time concerned. Big time. I mean, the pitch was fried eggs and veggie hash. First word is fried egg, right? And both Dawn and Sasha couldn't get it on the plate. And it's like, come on, that's the first thing. And I want to sit here and say, Dawn, you know, she learned from her first mistake, but she didn't. And that really worries me. And on Pack Your Knives Twitter, so it's at Pack Knives on Twitter, I asked people to send in their drafts that they posted. And one of the fascinating things that they did was Dawn's all over the map. Like, I picked her third. Someone else picked her second in their draft. But then Priyanka picked her in her draft 11th. Jacob Rosen, shout out to Jacob Rosen, friend of the program, picked Dawn in his draft. In their draft went 9th. No one really knows what to do with Dawn. And in the second episode, I'm a little nervous about her inability to put something on the plate that is essential to the competition. That is scary to me. And I think Dawn, I would have thought the opposite, is that as someone who's been in terms of global competitions at the highest levels of mankind, you have Dawn, who's just forgetting things. And that, to me, she's skating on thin ice here. And I'm very nervous about Dawn. If you want to offer me a deal for Dawn, I'm not sure I'm selling. She might be on the trade block if you're interested in trading for Dawn. But I'm just saying, this is making me very nervous at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, you know, would you take Maria for Dawn straight up right now?
Okay, Maria for Dawn straight up right now. Can I toss an Avishar? Avishar and Maria for Dawn.
Well, see, here's my issue, and I'm learning my lesson. Contestants are worth points. And so when you start having – the more contestants you have, yeah, you get the negative five if you lose. But by and large, I'm giving you points. What I would give you in the season 19 draft is a swap of my third pick. So it would either be five or six for your fourth pick, which would be either seven or eight.
See, that's not enough for me. I need a pick in addition. I mean, Dawn.
See, but I'm telling you, man, like I've learned my lesson. You kicked my ass three seasons in a row. And I think in two of those cases, the two for one thing is just it just doesn't work for me. I mean, it's like kind of what we argued about with, you know, do we kind of throw Roscoe in? And I just think that, look, the average, even a mediocre contestant, nets positive points, and I'm just throwing in points. And I realize, hey, I'm already saying that I think Dawn's going to score higher than Maria, but it's very hard for one contestant to score higher than two others combined. Am I right or wrong about that? Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're right here. So it's not about Avishar. It's about just sheer numbers of two contestants versus one.
Like, I'll give you Avishar for whoever you want to unload. If you want to go Avishar Byron as part of that deal, that's fine. I mean, take somebody, but I need to have a body, right? Like that's my issue is I can't keep giving up bodies because I think that's where I get my ass kicked every season. You're 3-0 against me. This is a point of real embarrassment for me, Tom. I'm not going to lose this season.
All right, I'm not ready to.
I like the Dawn for Maria deal, but let me know what else. We need another swap, and I'm open.
Okay. Would you do Maria and Brittany? Ooh. Okay.
You want to revisit this again in the end of the show?
Yeah, let's revisit because I think we've got the framework of a deal.
The tedium of these negotiations might drive our listeners crazy,
or they're geeking out on this because I'm not sure. So my team right now is Gabe, Dawn, Gabriel, Nelson, Kiki, Jamie, Byron. Yours is Shota, Sarah, Chris, Maria, Brittany, Sasha, Avishar. I'm looking at your team, and there are a couple interesting pieces there that I'm interested in on the other side of that trade call. Yeah. However, let's continue with the show and revisit at the end. I think we might have skipped over Dale Talde's spam and kimchi fried rice, which might have been my favorite prompt of all of them. I mean, the idea sounds delicious to me.
And by the way, both dishes sounded great. I mean, I love what Maria – I mean, chorizo is such a great breakfast item. You know, it's got some spice. It's got some fat. You know, that nice – you know what I like to do is like the chorizo grease you mix with whatever the starch is on the plate. Like it's just – chipotle chorizo is a really smart modification there. But the pineapple apparently made the day. Pineapple is a very controversial ingredient in savory food. You know, like the great pineapple on pizza debate. Some people don't like their pineapple in a savory situation. How do you feel about this?
I think this is a very Gabriel move. Gabriel's very controversial, which we'll talk about later in the show. But putting pineapple in this dish is, you know, it depends on the eye of the beholder here. I think Dale enjoyed that, liked that aspect. I'm a fan. Personally, I'm a fan of the pineapple in a pork fried rice. I'm also a fan, not necessarily like – I'm not a zealot about the pineapple ham – the Hawaiian pizza. Like I used to eat that as a kid. I kind of grown out of that a little bit, but I'm not against it. So Gabriel putting the seared pineapple in this dish, I think is a very Gabriel move. He's a bit, bold, I get maybe is the right word. Gabriel does win this one, but I think Maria had a really strong dish too. I think it kind of could have gone both ways.
I got the sense that, as you did, that maybe that was the closest of the seven competitions there.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So then Carrie, of course, the fancy toast comes into play. Love the fancy toast reference. Of course, it's here. Brittany and Kiki go head to head.
Yeah. You know, so Brittany had a tough elimination challenge, obviously, but I kind of, you're starting to see what she does. It's so much different than any other chef, which is she does yummy beige food, right? She has this Bavarian thing going at her restaurants. This mushroom machango baguette looked so very good.
God, it looks so good.
I'm not a big Spanish cheese guy. There's always a kind of I don't like the texture and the salt content as much as like French and Italian cheeses, but like this is a really good looking dish. As by the way, as is avocado and green harissa toast with Kiki. This is another one I think that was probably close. You know, it's funny. Kiki's been in the middle pretty much everywhere. I like her. I kind of like what I'm seeing. I think, first of all, I don't think she's going out anytime soon. I think there's just a base competence there that is going to carry her for several weeks. I don't see any mistakes. So I got to tell you, like, Kiki's somebody on your board I kind of covet as well.
Okay.
But Brittany, I think is, look, we'll talk about the elimination challenge. But I think Brittany's a really skilled chef. And even though that was fancy toast, which, as you know, all the chefs in the Carrie season kind of loathe as being a cop-out dish. Look, she makes good tasting food.
Right. And when it comes to fancy toast, I think Kiki, I'm actually going the other way on this one. Avocado toast seems almost too trendy and on the nose for this one. And I would have liked to have seen her kind of be a little bit more creative with this dish. Brittany, like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, that dish looked like, if I'm seeing that on a spread at a brunch, I am all over it. And then, of course,
that is hangover food extraordinaire.
Yeah, right? And I'm a sucker for mushrooms and cheese. Like, come on, it's incredible. So then, finally, with Richard Blaze, who at this point just is so comfortable up there, it seems like he could be the fourth, you know, guest judge or fourth, you know, permanent judge on this show.
Tom, we've got to get Blaze on again.
We got to do it.
We've got to. I mean, Richard, if you're listening to this, we got to get you on. That's still my favorite episode we've ever done.
Yeah. Oh, it was a banger. Richard Blaze, we want you back on the show, and I'd love to eat a corned beef hash, eggs over medium. Interesting choice with the medium. I'm more of a easy
guy. I want that yolk, that viscosity of the really runny yolk. I love that, yeah.
I was a kid who would get the corned beef hash, pop open that can, throw it on the fryer, and I could eat the whole damn thing. I am such a sucker for that spammy, salty pork, beefy, like all that stuff. I'm a big fan of breakfast food. The hollandaise thrown in, like we said at the top, this is like saying, you know,
it's a straight up troll, Tom.
It is, and I appreciate the theatrics of it. It's fun for the game show, but I also really liked that they gave him kind of a little handicap here in the grading of it, being like, yeah, of course you can't like do all of those things in just 10 minutes. So I liked that. Nelson, man, I love Nelson. He just seems like he's going to bring his Dominican Caribbean flavors on every dish, and it's the same thing with Brittany, where I think it might be an advantage here coming from their restaurants where they know it's a specific ethnic food or nationality where they're coming in with a certain culture that is going to frame their dish every time when they cook, as opposed to someone who's got like a kaleidoscope of different backgrounds that or kitchens that they've worked at. I actually think Nelson and Brittany's framing is really an advantage here for them.
Yeah. One of the things I like so far is, you know, we've got a sense of maybe the elite top, but I think there's a whole cluster of chefs that we're still kind of – that are going to reveal themselves over the next few weeks, right? The level of creativity, the level of technicality, just kind of the level of the cook. You know, can you execute a protein? Can you, like, execute a pasta, right? And I think that's – Nelson is a particularly interesting candidate here, as is Brittany. You know, I mean, she's got major accolades. And look, it goes back to that conversation we have with Tyler Anderson, which is, you know, to what extent does this show tell you who is the best chef of the group? And to what extent is this a game that is so specific in its demands that where you rank as a chef, granted that's a subjective measure, has really very little correlation to where, not zero, but less of a correlation to your success on the show than anyone might imagine who's watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really hard.
We're seeing that with Dawn.
Yeah. It's really hard to peg right now. We're two episodes in. Of course, we don't really know if these, you know, the small sample size theater is real or false. Like I'm looking at Jamie, who wins the quickfire after saying, "I have anxiety with competitions. I don't know why." Like that, when she said that, Kevin, I was like, "Oh, I'm fucked." Like, there's no way Jamie's gonna last long in this competition. Then she fucking wins the quickfire. You know, like I don't know what to make of her or Dawn. Brittany shows out in this quickfire and then kind of falls on her face in an elimination challenge. So after quickfire, the only thing we know, I think, at this point, is that Gabe and Shota are on another plane. That's my feeling. Is there's a tier system, and I think Shota, you might have Shota in his own tier, but I think I have Gabe or Alice in that tier as well.
Yeah, I think Gabe's really strong. Yeah, I'm not willing to give up on Sarah's elite. I mean, I think it's a question of confidence, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Yeah, but I'm with you. The other cluster is really fascinating, and Jamie showed a lot. You know, and she did fine in the elimination, even with immunity, which sometimes can be sort of not a disincentive, but certainly kind of quell any like extra motivation you have to just like bust ass. So let's talk about the elimination challenge. As we teased up top, Tom, you love these scenarios.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, from the beginning, it's, you know, pull knives and basically decide which team you're going to be on, team coffee or team beer. I drink coffee every morning. I probably drink beer. I compensate for you giving up your beer, and I have drank more beer since you've given up than probably you have in your entire life. I love beer. I love a hazy IPA. I love stouts. And I think for this competition, you know, I really like the idea of a chocolate stout or a coffee stout. It works really well. And I was just thinking that coffee or beer, when they first started this, I was like, ooh, what if you just did both? And then sure enough, later we find out that you kind of do have to do both. But they pull knives.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like,
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
And you know, you get the two teams, coffee or beer. Which one would you have been more excited about if you had drawn a knife, coffee or beer, Kevin, if you had to cook a meal with one of those two things?
Yeah, it's a really tough call because each one offers something different. Like coffees are great for rubs, and you saw that some of the winners, that's exactly how they utilize it. Also, like coffee can be a great texture. Like I love like the coffee crunch if executed well. There were some bad coffee crunches clearly in this competition, but it can be a really nice little additive to give texture to a dish that might need it. But beer also is nice, and we saw – you know, and we saw this with Gabriel,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like a, so it's interesting. You said that, you know, the chocolate stout, a sour beer can really offer that particular flavor component. And so, you know, for a braise, like I love, like the chili I used to make, this had a ton of beer in it. Right. And so it can be a really nice sour, component to a dish. And we saw that with a compressed watermelon, just, you know, perfect with this sort of sweet sour combination. So it's tough. I mean, I think
like you're pulling the knife. Like which one are you hoping for?
I mean, here's what I'm doing. I'm hoping for coffee because now I do kind of a coffee rubbed grilled salmon.
Wow.
Right. Like to me, that's such a great dish. Grilling salmon is fantastic because it's fatty and it can hold up on the grill. I love like you do a, here's what I would have done. A coffee and chili powder and smoked paprika rub or something like that. A little ground mustard in there too, right? Maybe actually some sugar. So, and then I just do the grilled salmon. And so I'm hoping for coffee in that respect.
Kevin, there's a twist here. They go to the restaurant. They think they're on team coffee or beer. And Tom Colicchio comes in and says, "Hey, what's going on? How's it going?" Everyone gets super nervous. Why is Tom here? This is a curveball waiting to happen. And I was curious to see what this curveball was going to be. And this is one of my favorite things is we're now in the backyard, schoolyard, pick your teams. All right, you guys to pick a partner and blend the two dishes into one and make sure you have an element that is entirely yours. That's the pitch. That's the prompt. And man, so many interesting things happen here, Kevin.
Yeah, what did you think was the most revealing combination?
To me, it's that no one wanted to pair up with Shota. That one.
Oh, I thought it. The fact that like everybody should have been flocking to the guy.
No, I think it was fascinating that no one wanted to go with him because if there's going to be a winner, it's going to be Shota. And so going against Shota or being paired with Shota, here's when you're with Shota, it just makes you look worse as a chef. And even though you might have a winning dish, I think you have the lesser. Actually, I don't know. Now I'm thinking about it. I mean, do you want to pair with Shota just because you're going to win?
It's basically de facto immunity.
I don't know.
I think you definitely pair with Shota.
I don't know, because if you're not...
And Avishar is smart enough to realize.
I don't know, because if you're not on his level, I kind of feel like you might drag it down where you have a... It's very clear that who did the best thing on the dish and it might drag... Like, it's almost like, you know,
but you're not
going to
have the worst of... There's no way Shota's going to have the worst of seven dishes. Mm. It's basically immunity. Avishar got immunity. When the minute he ran or whatever, they stumbled into one another, their eyes met across the crowded room, whenever you want to characterize it, is he got immunity. There was no way. And so, okay, who cares? And by the way, they didn't name an individual winner. They got both got a W.
That's right. That's right. So that's interesting. I went the opposite direction, is that not many people wanted to go with Shota, and then Avishar finally said it. All right, let's link up here. The other thing I thought was interesting, Kevin, is the Jamie aspect. Jamie has immunity, officially has immunity. Would you have gone with Jamie simply because of the immunity letdown factor? Is that immunity is going to naturally bring you down in a dish, just because you might not focus as much? But I might go with Jamie because of that factor that they discussed here, is if the dish falls apart, I'm going to jump on the grenade because I have immunity. And so you're almost, by virtue of teaming up with Jamie, you're sharing in that immunity because she's going to fall on the grenade. I thought that was fascinating.
Nah, man, I'm running as far away from the immunity contestant as possible, because as you know, right? And we've seen this, I think, and I can't recall a specific incident where a team lost the person with immunity by all rights, should have gone home, but they say, you're lucky you have immunity because you'd be going home. They get scolded like from the disappointed dad, Tom. And then the poor schmuck who was second, who did actually outrun the person who outran the bear, still gets eaten. Because I go so far away from Jamie, because there's 100% chance if you were on the bottom as the dish collectively, that you were going home, irrespective of what you do.
It comes down to the trust factor with Jamie. Is Jamie going to be willing to eat that L and say, and step up and say, look, that was me that overcooked the chicken.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because she can't go home. Tom, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you have the good component and she has the bad component. This is the only situation where you can go down, even if you have the better component.
I still think that's an advantage. Linking up, Kiki linking up.
What are you talking about?
Because she can fall on the sword and she can't go home. And
what
so
is falling on the sword? So give me the scenario where the other person doesn't go home when she falls on the sword. What's the scenario?
Well, as we saw, there were multiple teams in the bottom. And so if the dish goes bad because, let's say, Kiki overcooked a chicken or something like that, Jamie says, look, it was me who overcooked the chicken. That was my fault. And the judges sit there and say, I'm not going to punish Kiki for something that Jamie did. So you know what? Kiki, you survive. I'm going to move my attention to the other.
I don't think there's a history of them doing that. I don't think there's a history of the show doing that. What they typically do is take the worst dish, and if the person who has immunity is on the team, the next person gets screwed.
No.
I mean, that's generally what happens.
That's not what's going through my head, Kevin. My head says,
like, I don't think the judges ever switch dishes because they don't want to punish the immunity person. I think they, I mean, my understanding, and tell me if there's another example, is they pick they identify the worst dish, and then they take the worst eligible chef to go home. And if the worst eligible chef cannot go home because of immunity, it's the next person who goes home.
It could be.
I don't want anything to do with Jamie in that scenario. I run the other side of the room. I grab, I grab a ham sandwich and say, I'm working with this guy. What? Like, I don't want anything to do with
that. That's fair. I get your perspective, but I still think Jamie, when she put it on the table and said, hey, let's make a pact. If it's a bad dish, I'm going to jump on the grenade. I thought that was a really smart strategic decision. And
by the way, I thought it was a classy statement.
Yes. And I think it saved Kiki from a little bit of the pressure of like, now I'm with the immunity contestant. That's a load off, because she's willing to use the full expansion of the full spectrum of her immunity and take the L. No matter whether that would have happened or not, we don't know. But that was interesting. Any other schoolyard picking of teams dynamics here that was highlighted for you?
I mean, not so much that. I mean, I thought Kiki and Nelson was a really fun match. And again, linguistically, they were both really excited to have that experience. I mean, there's a cautionary tale in all this, right? And they were almost annoyingly precious. But like, Sasha and Brittany are now under the impression that camaraderie and goodwill can somehow produce a dish.
Mm-hmm.
As if you don't actually have to have a conception. Like, we're friends, big and bright. Yeah, and you're going down. Like, give me the contrast between Dawn and Gabriel in this competition and Sarah and Brittany, right? Like Dawn and Gabriel going at it a little bit, right?
I love
like
this juxtaposition, Kevin. Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, and what does it produce? Basically a dish that got within a hair of winning the whole thing, right? Like give me two hard-headed, but competent and driven competitive show. And they're both competitive. And the collective competitiveness really produced a good outcome versus the, you know, we're sisters in happiness and we're going to produce an absolute dish of dog food.
Kevin, you need some tough love in these scenarios, right? You need someone to say, this needs more salt. This needs a little bit more tang. This one's undercooked. We need to cook it a little longer. Gabriel and Dawn were the epitome of this, where I think Gabriel should not have gone as far as he did with Dawn and chef-splaining how to make ribs for someone who fucking does this in her sleep, like she said.
Yes.
And Gabriel went way over the top on this, but you know what? I like the dynamic of someone giving someone what they maybe not want to hear, but need to hear. And I think Gabriel is willing to step out and say, hey, you know, I think this actually needs less of that or more of that. Whereas Brittany and Sasha, they were not giving each other tough love. They thought everything was just rainbows and butterflies. And so they put it on the dish and they both of them thought, hey, what are we doing here on the bottom? I thought we did a pretty good dish. And the issue is, there was no blending. There was no like, hey, let's take elements from both of our dishes and make an entirely new dish. And that's the kind of thing that you need when you're brainstorming is, hey, let's not do two separate things. Let's bring it together and reinvent the dish. And that's what Gabriel and Dawn did. They completely redid their dish.
Well, they did something different, actually, that really, I think, speaks well of both of them, which is there's two ways to go. You're absolutely right. Like you find components, or you just one chef stands down and just says, hey, we'll go with yours. I'll make the support, you know, I'll make the accompaniments, be at the, you know, sort of the side and the garnishes. And, you know, it's funny for, you know, Gabriel was both the biggest egoist in the competition and the smallest egoist in the competition, right? Like in certain sense, he's bossy. Again, chef's blaming the use of black pepper. But on the other hand, I really applauded. And even Dawn acknowledged, like, hey, it showed a lot of largeness, right? Like he basically said, hey, man, we're going with your entree. I'll do something else. We'll figure out something fun for me to do. And I think that, you know, the irony is for all of their happy, as you say, you know, butterflies and rainbows, one of them didn't have the gumption to say, hey, I'm standing down. Let's go with your dish. Let's figure out how to make me useful. And that was very much both in the winning dish, Shota and Abhishar, and Dawn and Gabriel, which appeared to be the runner-up dish. That was the formula, was one person took over, the other kind of worked as Sue, and it came out beautiful.
Which one would you have eaten preferred, the Abhishar and Shota's dish or the Gabriel and Dawn, the ribs?
Oh, I mean, I go with Shota and Abhishar. I'm a sucker for like Japanese in like, you know, molecular gastronomy with Japanese, wow. With like also, you know, it's interesting. I learned something. I always thought Tsunamono was the name of the salad that is the vinegar based cucumber salad. I didn't realize that Tsunamono is just vinegar in general.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't have to be cucumbers. It could be a fish. So that was something I learned, but like that double cream coffee stout reduction, like, and I love, you know, it's funny. The carbonated grapes are very 8 years ago. While we haven't been looking, molecular gastronomy sort of had its peak about 7-8 years ago, and it's sort of, you don't see it present in the restaurants we go to as much anymore. Like those places, sort of the Alinea tree is not producing as much, like places like that. Even Michael Voltaggio's place in my town, Inc., which played a lot with that. Like it's becoming less of a trend. We're going back. And I'm wondering after COVID, if we actually, it even drops even more because we're going to be looking for kind of comfort food.
Mm. I thought it was really smart, Abhishar, doing something that was unquestionably his here. And he had the confidence right to do the carbonated grapes. Kudos to Abhishar on that. I want to move over to Chris and Byron here.
Mm-hmm.
They did the duck breast with the coffee tortellini. It didn't make sense to me, Kevin. Did it make that dish just didn't come together for me?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could have. I do like kind of a pasta with a protein. Here's a game theory question I had for you. So in that scenario, so Byron is watching Chris make fundamental errors. You have two choices. One is, in an effort to make sure you're not on the bottom, you really point it out. You edit your partner. You say, hey, man, you got to try again. Like, press that pasta a little thinner, right? Or given that, and I made this kind of analogy earlier, do you just worry that, hey, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun the other guy. As long as my partner makes a crappier element than me. I got my duck. I'm going to execute the protein. He's screwing up the pasta. Hey, you know what? I'm just going to get out of the way, keep my mouth shut, because I know that even if we end up on the bottom, he's going down and I'm not. All I have to do is make a better component on this plate than he does. Because that is actually the competition, right? The competition is, hey, collectively, we need to make sure we don't make the seventh best dish. But there's a sub-competition, which is if you truly want to guarantee your survival, it's not even about finishing on the bottom collectively. It's about my component is better. It's a competition. The funny thing is your partners, you're the utmost partner with your partners, but you're also competitors.
Yeah.
And I think that decision that Byron makes, and I'm not saying he did it deliberately. He might've just been, hey, I want to be a nice guy here. I'm not going to tell a guy what to do. But by virtue of keeping his mouth shut, he actually ensured his survival.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that Byron said it's tasting a little thick here at the top. Like initially he might've did a soft, like, hey, you know, it's a little al dente or something like that. It's too thick, for me right now, maybe thinning out, because I think that's the move, Kevin, because what I fear about doing the latter where you're basically saying, hey, he's screwing up. I'm going to let him screw up because that makes me look better by virtue of him. He's going to be the last one, in that bear chase. But I think if you do that, you run the risk of going to the judges' table and Tom Colicchio or Padma or Gail saying, you tasted the dish, right? Why didn't you say something? And then you're caught in a tough spot, because then it seems like it's transparent that you were letting him sabotage himself and you weren't being partners in a dish. So I think you have to, Kevin, you have to at least check the box off and say, I suggested him to thin out the pasta or cook it a little bit longer. And if he still goes forward with it, then that you're done. You're good. You're clean. Your hands are clean and you've already put in your suggestion and you move off. So I think what Byron did initially, being like, when he tasted it first, I believe he made a little suggestion and then he kept doing it. And at that point you just say, you know what? That's your bad. I mean, if you're going to go forward with that dish after I've made a suggestion, a slight suggestion, then I'm not going to hammer you and try to do it again. You've already made your bed. So Chris, with the coffee tortellini, where they were like, I don't know where the coffee, oh, it's in the tortellini. Okay. And then it was just too thick, chalky, and I guess too al dente, undercooked. I think Chris was in very much danger of getting sent home for that.
Yeah. And to speak more broadly about Chris, I'll be honest with you. I had him very high on my draft board. I like the pedigree. To me, in the pilot, or not the pilot, the first episode, he kind of demonstrated a, you know, technical competence. I think he's a generally creative chef. Even what he came up with and conceived with the pasta, I thought was very smart. The coffee laces, it was a gorgeous dish had it been executed. I think the flavors he has selected thus far have impressed me. And I had high hopes for Chris. I'll be honest with you. I had him as my fourth or fifth on my board overall coming into the draft. You know, I wanted to get him. And I was hoping I could get him at 7, and I did, because I didn't know if you had him highly ranked. So I'm a little concerned on that. Like, I thought this was a really sound technical chef, and I just worry that if you can't execute a pasta or something so basic as knowing whether your pasta is gummy or it's got that kind of flour bitterness or, you know, whatever it is. So I'm a little worried, and because I really thought he was going to be one of these, hey, he'll play air-free ball for a while. He'll get into the final eight, and, you know, he'll be in Restaurant Wars and we'll go from there. You know, I got real concern here for different reasons than you do with Dawn.
Yeah, and I also noticed he had a sad clap when he wasn't in the top top half of this, or he wasn't in the top three or whatever we want to call it. You could see him in the back just doing this, like, sad clap to the winners of the challenge. And, you know, I just noted that is that Chris did not have a great showing this episode. And
I thought he did okay on the cheddar black garlic hash. I mean, to me, again, the black garlic, that's a smart in the, you know, that's a smart way to do that dish. I thought he did incredibly well with Richard's kitchen.
He almost got sent home. He almost got sent home.
No, I know. And that's my concern. But I think, as you said earlier, one of the interesting things about the first three or four episodes is the small sample size, right? Is this going to be indicative of a trend going forward, or did he have a bad week? And again, I mean, I question the strategy, like pasta making. I mean, unless that's your shtick, and you know, obviously plenty of chefs have come through that, you know, like the Joe Sasto, do you even futz with that in a round of 14 where, again, all you have to do is outrun, you know, you get one of 13 contestants. And so that to me is, you know, judgment call there, but I'm not convinced this is a guy who I need to worry about immediately, but it did give me pause.
Yeah. And look, if they were doing like a duck ragu with pasta, like that dish would make sense to me. But the fact that it seemed like there were two dishes put into one, I thought was a drawback. And of course they go into the bottom, yeah. Brittany and Sasha, they were surprised they were in the bottom. And I think Sasha and Brittany, might've produced the worst dish. I think maybe if you're going to go with the theory who produced the worst element of the four that were in the bottom, Byron, Sasha, Brittany, and Chris, you might send Chris home, but Sasha goes home, because of her romesco. And then the dish didn't really come together.
It was a mess. And again, camaraderie is not going to produce a dish. I don't care how good the energy is with your partner. It doesn't do the cook. And just from a personal standpoint, and I'm just being petty, like there was a preciousness that kind of annoyed me about the whole shtick. Like, just like put your game face on. It's like why I like Dawn. Like, hey, you know, Sarah's fine in the self-deprecation, you know, can get a little excessive, but at the end of the day, like it's internal rather than external. And, you know, anyway, so, that's it. I mean, I lose, Sasha.
Yeah.
Toni Collette is gone, is no longer in the cast, and she gets bumped to Last Chance Kitchen, which Tom had its debut this week. Tell us about Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah. Always great to have Last Chance Kitchen back. Just 12 minutes of pure Top Chef goodness. Colicchio is at his, you know, dad joke finest. You need to have thick skin to win in this competition. And here we have some thick skin foods in this quick fight or Last Chance Kitchen competition. So they had a series of thick skinned elements. They had the pistachio, they had the jackfruit, they had clams and oysters, etc. And they had to basically choose three and chop style, make a dish with those three. So with Sasha going against Roscoe, it was, you know, it was a tough draw. I mean, Sasha had to do oysters, pistachio, and cherimoya. I've never even heard of that before. So I was very interested to see what that was all about. And then Roscoe went with clams, peanuts, and jackfruit. I don't know how to cook either of those two fruits there. So it was really interesting to see that Sasha just made a dish that, as far as Tom Colicchio is concerned, I can't remember a dish that he loved as much as this one on Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, Sasha can cook. And I think, again, it was conception. Well, it was execution, too, on that romesco. But I think, like, that was a gorgeous dish. I mean, that looked delicious. And she combined the elements beautifully. Yeah, I mean, this could be an LCK contestant to be reckoned with. We've talked about it a bunch of times in the last few years. But I think LCK, in terms of sort of what a mainline television show can do as a digital element add-on, is brilliant. Like just, it is an accomplishment of digital media to have essentially a show within the show, 12 minutes of additional programming that can pick up sponsorship, that it can be produced, by the way, within the confines of the existing set and the infrastructure of the show with the existing talent. Like LCK should get an award, an Emmy or digital Emmy award for just ingenuity in that element. Like I just purely from a television production standpoint, like it is a, I love LCK.
Yeah.
And so do you. And it just, I'm, that's all I'll say. It is just, it's an achievement from a television and digital standpoint.
Yeah. And what I like about it is I think Tom's just grazing by the table and talking to the chefs. Some of my favorite elements of the show is when you get the chefs getting so like uncomfortable. The Jen Carroll-ness of it is just like, oh shit, Tom's coming over here. Like, I love that part of Top Chef. And you get that in full purity in this, in Last Chance Kitchen, is that you get the little nerves. But you know who's not showing nerves is Sasha. Sasha is so good on this show in terms of she seems so comfortable and she's got the right personality. She's the opposite of Jen Carroll. It's like when Tom comes over to the table, I notice Sasha's making eye contact and totally there with him. Whereas Jen is like feverishly working on her dish and not, and just trying to ignore Tom. Sasha's there. Sasha is just vibing with Tom and is willing to just like, you know, have a conversation while she's cooking. There's a certain like serene calm to her in this competition that I would not be surprised if she came out on top and got back into the competition.
Yeah, she is the, especially in the elimination, she is the human embodiment of the little dog sipping the coffee while the house burns down. Right? Like that was her in the elimination. We love the dish, right? Like, and I always have a certain respect for those contestants. You know, I really like her personality. I mean, I just, you know, but yeah, I think that was a gorgeous dish in LCK. So Tom, what are we looking for next week? What is some information on the field of contestants you're still trying to glean?
Yeah, Jamie is the number one thing for me, is trying to figure out Jamie. She feels like Brian Malarkey to me. This season's Malarkey, because for all of the class clownish, you know, annoying stuff that Malarkey does, that I kind of feel like Jamie's shtick of making sounds like the dude from Police Academy, I kind of feel like that might get tiresome and it might rub the contestants a little wrong, where it's just like, oh, this again, the same way where Malarkey was just doing that and then just doing amazing in the competition. I'm curious to see if Jamie, because as we've talked about her background and her Vegas restaurant, fantastic. I'm curious. I'm really curious about Jamie and her ability to produce at a high level while having that amazing character trait, is that she just loves to speak in sounds. That's, you know, the fact that she says she has anxiety with competitions, it doesn't bode well for her. But I think that's probably the number one thing. I know what I'm getting from Shota and Gabe and Sarah. The other contestants, I'm really into Maria. And if you're willing to, Kevin, if you're willing to entice a deal, I want to do Maria and Brittany for Dawn and Maria and Brittany for Dawn and Kiki.
Oh, that's a really interesting offer. Yeah, let's do it.
Maria and Brittany is now on Team Haverstraw, and Dawn and Kiki is on Team Arnovitz. Fascinating.
Let's do it.
So you're buying low on Dawn. You're.
I think I'm buying low on Dawn. I mean, does the time management worry me? Yes, but I just you noted it in the draft episode, which is there's a competitiveness in this chef that suggests that she will overcome this issue, that she's not going to let it be fatal. There's nothing. And again, how interesting is it that even when she doesn't get a key element on the plate, the judges are like, oh, this is good. Right. Like, imagine, and by the way, look at her ribs. Did you see how clean that rib was, Tom, that the judges were sucking on? You could put that in your toolbox.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? She's yours now. She's yours.
I'm sorry to see. I think Brittany is better than was demonstrated this week. Like I'm a little sad to see Brittany, but I'll tell you what, I'm confident enough in Kiki's competence, right? Yeah. The avocado toast wasn't the most creative choice, but she nailed it. It looked good. She has yet to produce anything that's been on the bottom. And so to me, I'm not worried that I'm going to eat a negative five in the next couple of weeks there. you know. So I love this trade. It was a tough one. I got to say, it was a 51-49 proposition, but I accept it. I will now acquire Don. You want to do the trade call with the league?
Yeah, we'll do a trade call with the league. Team Haberstroh is trading Don and Kiki to Team Arnovitz for Maria and Brittany. The trade is going to go through after the scoring of this second episode of Top Chef. So all of the points that they have acquired at this point still goes to their original yes. teams. But henceforth, Don and Kiki are going to be producing points for Team Arnovitz, and Maria and Brittany are going to Team Haberstroh. And the scoreboard is, Kevin, 27 Kevin to 26 Haberstroh. And you get the two top winners in Avishar and Shota. And Shota was the top in the quickfire. So you get two big winners in this episode, but you get the loser in Sasha. She picked up a quickfire point and a last chance kitchen point by beating Roscoe. But still, it is a close match after one, because I had a bunch of folks in the top three or in the top half of the competition. They might not have won, but I still like my team, and now I get Maria and Brittany. I think Maria is a real sleeping dragon here.
I think she's good, and that was tough to part with her. I'll tell you that was. But I really believe in Dawn. I'm loving the season, Tom. I like the way the season is shaping out. The field is interesting. A lot of contrast in styles. A lot of contrast in sort of creativity,
personalities.
It's a really good one. Final words.
Roscoe, miss you, buddy. Can't wait to eat your food wherever you end up. I'm going to definitely miss having him around the show. I thought he had a good last chance kitchen dish, but RIP to his Top Chef competition. I wish I could have watched him longer.
No, there's an endearing irony. I love the person, and we will miss that voice and contestant. He is just one of a kind. For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.